Hi, this is Joe Patty. Thanks for listening to WRTI Online. This service is made possible through the support of WRTI's members. You can become a member, too. Since you're already online, just visit www.wrti.org and click the Become a Member link on the upper left corner of the webpage. You can also join us by phone at 1-866-809-9784. Your membership will help keep WRTI's broadcast and online services strong. And again, thank you. Now, on with the show.
For many years, the name John Rutter has been associated with a long tradition of English choral music. One of the most frequently performed composers, his own works have broad appeal both musically and technically and have been performed all over the world. Mr. Rutter is our guest today on Crossover. Mr. Rutter.
It is.
This is Jill Pasternak from WRTI. Oh, I love your music, and I just wanted to commend you on everything that you have done to date. And, of course, one of the things that is terribly popular here at the station we play all the time is your Sweet Antique.
Yes.
It's very accessible, and people love it, and so on.
I keep meaning to do, and I hope I'll get to it, some little concertinos or suites or whatever for the other woodwind instruments, because... so far, it is only that one for flute.
Yes, and a harpsichord, I guess. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Now, but you really, your first love has been liturgical music. Is that right?
Well, let's say choral music and the voice generally, because I grew up singing.
Tell us a little bit about, you were born in London, is that right?
I was born in London. I knew I wanted to compose from a very early age. I climbed up to the old piano in my parents' apartment and started picking out tunes on it when I must have been no more than 4 or 5 years old. And at about the same time, I discovered singing and was fortunate to go to a school where there was a fine choir. Mm-hmm. And from the age of about 8 or 9, I was singing along with the other kids and just having the time of my life. The sort of thrill that I suppose sporting kids might get out of being in a baseball team. But for me, I got that kind of excitement from choral singing. And so, in a way, the voice is something that's run all the way through my career, but which goes back the earliest. And in a way, I discovered instruments and writing for orchestra a little bit later, but I still love to do that also.
Also, England has a very strong choral tradition, I believe.
Well, this is true. With all of our 50 cathedral choirs, of course, that is a very strong part of our musical heritage, though I myself never sang in a cathedral choir. In fact, my parents wanted me to audition for St. Paul's Cathedral Choir in London. But I actually said, no, I don't want to do that, because I think I was afraid that I wouldn't get to be home for Christmas, because the choir does sing on Christmas Day. In
and
any
you
of
love our... Christmas, I understand. It's
well,
very important.
I do, but I think I was more worried about the presents that I thought I wouldn't get. and so, for whatever reason, I think probably more seriously, I didn't want to go to boarding school so young. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to be away from my mum and dad.
Yes.
And, of course, it is quite young that you have to start. I mean, as a boy chorister in a cathedral choir, you join at the age of about 8. And so I would have been away from home. And that was something that I think I wasn't ready for. But, of course, I did get the experience of singing in some fine choirs.
But your compositional career, I mean, that's something. When did that really start?
Well, I suppose it started when I began to write down some of the things that I was just improvising and making up at the piano. And that must have been when I was 10 or 11. And I showed them to my director of music at school. And he said, well, you know, maybe you should try making the beats add up to 4 in a bar or 3 in a bar, because I was a little erratic and untutored at that point.
Yes.
But I got some very good guidance and some very good encouragement. And above all, I was enabled to feel that there's nothing abnormal or weird about composition, you know, because I was by no means the only person in my high school doing it. We had quite a number of us, including my now very eminent composer friend, Sir John Tavener. Of course,
oh,
he didn't have
course.
The knighthood then, but
oh, my,
we were
yes.
best buddies at high school. Uh-huh. And showed each other our compositions and had a kind of friendly rivalry. Mm-hmm. And there were several others, too, who've ended up in the world of composition. And so it seemed like a normal thing to do. And it wasn't until later that I realized it's actually quite an unusual thing to do. And nobody warned me off it. And if they had, I mean, I think I wouldn't have taken any notice. But if people had said, well, you do realize this is a very precarious and insecure career. And after all, the kind of music that I was writing when I started in the 1960s was way out of step with the mainstream of contemporary musical life.
I was going to say, of course.
Well, it was very avant-garde in those days. And there was a lot of highly experimental music written, which I was intrigued by and enjoyed, but which I just knew I didn't want to write myself. That, in a sense, I've been one of those leftover composers who, I think it was Arnold Schoenberg, said there's plenty of good music left in C major. And I guess I'm one of those who's wanted to try and write some of it. And so I do like writing tunes, and I like being able to be accessible to a wide audience.
Well, I must say that you are, and also the songs that you write, the choral music is, there is a sweetness, and it's, I don't want that to sound, you know, I mean, that word sweet is not, you know, it's like jeune fille in French, but actually I think, there's a special quality, and it's kind of like a little poignancy sometimes in some of the things that you've written. They're really delightful, the carols, and I think they're quite singable, as a matter of fact, because they're done so very, very much here in the States. But there is a special quality that you have about your writing. It's not that simplistic, but it certainly touches everyone's heart.
Well, that's a lovely compliment. Thank you. And if I can touch someone's heart, I mean, that's, I think, what I would like written as my epitaph, because in a way there's a triangular relationship between composer and performer and audience, and it's like the three legs of a stool, that if you take any one of those mm-hmm. legs away, then the stool falls down.
That's right.
And it seems to me that if a composer can't reach out to an audience and let them feed something back into what he's doing, then there's something wrong. And it's always been important to me not to exclude anybody by making what I write too complicated on purpose.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And, of course, in order to write something simple, you sometimes have to work harder. I know I do.
Oh, yes.
Than if you're trying to write something complex, because what you often do with a first sketch is write something which has maybe got too many frills and fancies attached to it. And you then have to say, well, what can I strip away? How can I make this simpler? And that is what I do. And, of course, the difficult thing is to not take so much away from it that you're left like the peeled onion with nothing. And so that's been one of the challenges I've had to meet all my life, because, of course, in writing for choir, you're mostly writing for students or amateurs.
Yes.
That there are very few fully professional choirs anywhere in the world. And, of course, if there were, then anybody's choral music would be more complicated. In the same way as if opera companies were all amateurs, then I guess Tristan and Isolde would have been a lot simpler.
Well, no, that's what I'm saying. I think your music is sung a great deal, and because I think not only is it is learnable, if there is such a word. I mean, it's easy for a choir to learn. Not easy, but I mean, they can do it. But there's also that very, very special quality, as I said before. Something like, you know, What Sweeter Music, or the what is it, the carol that I love so much, the angel, what is it, the
Angel's Carol?
Yeah, I love that. That's a beautiful thing. Now, you have also been responsible for creating, is it your own label or a label for choral music?
Yes, it is my own label. When I formed the Cambridge Singers as my own choir in the early 1980s, I got asked to make several recordings for established labels, and although it was fun and I don't regret it, I always felt in the end that I wanted more freedom to make my own recording projects in my own way, even down to deciding the cover design if I wished to do that. And I thought that, well, it was a very exciting time in the early 1980s because compact discs were just coming in.
Mm-hmm.
And it became possible, thanks also to computer technology coming in, to actually run and make your own records in your own way and edit them afterwards with computer techniques and all of that. Something that wouldn't have been possible 10 years earlier. And at the same time, there was a growing market on disc for choral music. I think a lot of people realized that there's wonderful repertoire for choir, which had just never been recorded, because the major labels always thought, oh, choral music, it won't sell.
Yeah, and we so hear that all the time.
Yeah, well, you know, it's really not true, because quite a number of us in the 1980s began to record choral music and found that people just lapped it up, because there are centuries of repertoire. If you think about it, I mean, there's 1,000 years of choral music available to every choir. And, for example, with the realm of chamber music or orchestral music, you're really only drawing on 250 years, I suppose.
Yes.
And so, I mean, that's something that's always attracted me. Plus, of course, choirs can be so wide-ranging that a choir can be anything from a barbershop quartet to a group of monks chanting, to a mighty chorus with the Verdi Requiem in full cry. And that kind of versatility and wide-rangingness is something that always appealed to me. But when it came to starting my own choir and my own label to put it on, what I most wanted to do was have a mixed chamber choir of, well, we're normally about 28 voices, that kind of a size. Recording, and I have to be honest about this immediately, my own music as part of what we do, because it's kind of nice to have literally a record of how I want that piece to go, at least the day that I record it. And at the same time, to record the music of all kinds of other composers. Sometimes we do themed albums, as with this most recent one.
Yes, well, that's what I was going to ask you about.
Mm-hmm. But really to try and sometimes speak up on behalf of music which has been, for one reason or another, overlooked. And one of the things that I enjoy is going into the Cambridge University Library, which is not far from where I live, and just spending a day amongst all these mighty volumes of music and discovering some buried treasure. And so that's very much part of what I've been doing. It's been 25 years now
Yes. Since
I started the label. And, of course, none of the original Cambridge singers are still with me, because some of those early members have now gone on to fame and fortune as solo singers. Others have drifted away from choral singing, but new ones have come along. And it's wonderful to work with a new generation. I mean, I, as conductor, am allowed to grow old, I think.
You look more distinguished, I think.
Well, I don't know about that, but the young singers that I'm getting now are just tremendous. They're mostly in their 20s, fairly recently graduated, most of them from Cambridge, some from the various conservatories of music, and they're up for singing in a small select group, and particularly if the repertoire is interesting and adventurous.
Well, now you'll be performing at Carnegie Hall on November 26th.
Well, I will. Not, of course, with the Cambridge Singers, but it'll be me conducting a large chorus. It's an annual event in my life that on Thanksgiving weekend I go to Carnegie Hall to do the part one of Messiah, the Christmas portions. And I always feel that, in a sense, for me, it gets the whole Christmas season started with Handel's wonderful music, which I never do grow tired of. Then in the other half of the concert, I'm doing my Gloria and the Bernstein Chichester Psalm.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Which is a great piece.
Yeah, that's wonderful. It has lots of harp, too. So.
Oh, it does. And two harps.
Yes. I also want to commend you on the clarity of the label of Collegium, because it's really very easy to read. And nowadays, you know, being in a radio station, we get many, many discs in, and you just can't read the numbers. You can't read the writing, you know, when you file them. So this is, it's very, very workable, very accessible.
Well, the graphic design
Yes.
of our booklets is kind of important to us. And that's the one thing I do miss, LPs, vinyl LPs.
Yes,
everything was nice and big.
Mm.
And of course, it is all rather miniaturized in the CD era, but we still try to go for good, as you say, clear graphics.
It's clear, and of course the content is marvelous. Now tell us a little bit about what made you choose these the Light in Our Darkness repertoire. It's music for the close of day, you said.
The title, Light in Our Darkness, comes from one of the evening prayers that goes with the Anglican liturgy from our 1662 prayer book. And the idea for the album came to me while I was sitting in my study where I compose. I've got a little cottage that looks out over a field facing mm-hmm. westwards. And I was watching the sun go down one afternoon. And I thought there's that magic moment mm-hmm. when day and night meet. Mm-hmm. There's something just very poetic and evocative about evening. And then I began to think, well, I wonder if I could put together a collection of music appropriate to evening, to the close of day. And I got a bit of paper, began writing down some of my favorite pieces, and it became apparent very quickly that it was going to be a question of what am I going to leave out, because there's just some wonderful choral music suitable to evening, mostly liturgical, and a lot of it built around the last of the daily worship services from the medieval period, when the monks in their abbey or the nuns in their convent, before they went to bed, would sing one last worship service, and it's called Compline. It follows on from Vespers, and Compline it's quite short, lasts about 20 minutes, and it's a collection of psalms and prayers and scripture readings, and it's the last kind of moment of prayer and reflection and of music before everybody just goes to sleep, hopefully with their souls at peace.
And this is all, of course, a cappella, right?
It's all a cappella, and it was throughout the Middle Ages, it was pretty much clear that it was not said, but sung. Mm-hmm. And the chants do survive, and it's just a real little jewel of liturgy. It was suppressed at the Reformation in England because it involved like the Virgin Mary and other sort of Catholic elements. And
yes.
So it kind of went underground in the Anglican Church until fairly recent years where it's resurfaced. And you can only really celebrate Compline in a community like a college where everybody's sort of there on the spot because the point of it is that you just spend your 20 minutes with this lovely kind of little moment of candlelit peace and beauty, and then you go to bed immediately. And I thought, well, it would be lovely to just record this office of Compline straight through, and at the same time to record some of the wonderful music inspired by it, the polyphonic elaborations that would adorn this office in the kind of abbeys and churches where it was possible to do that. And the next stage in my thought, which was pretty much immediate, was that there's only one place in the world mm-hmm. I want to go and record all this music, and that's the Lady Chapel of Ely
yes.
Cathedral,
uh-huh.
which is our local cathedral, 16 miles north of Cambridge, mm-hmm. and attached to the cathedral is a gorgeous Lady Chapel, which was consecrated in 1372, and is a lofty stone-vaulted building where there is only natural light or candles, and this is the point for a musician, there is a glorious acoustic, 5 or 6 seconds of reverb, where you can sing chords with yourself. You know, if you sing 2 or 3 notes in rapid succession, then they kind of join up into this lovely rainbow of music. It's like
What an incredible experience that must be.
Oh, well, it is. I mean, my very first recording in 1966, which seems a long time ago now, was made in that building. And I've returned there from time to time over the years. And it's wonderful to bring a new generation of Cambridge singers to the Lady Chapel at Ely, because they walk through the door and they say, my goodness, this place is just evocative and magical. And then when they sing their first note in there and realize just what the acoustics do for the sound of a choir, then their jaws kind of drop and they look just awestruck. And there's this wonderful moment where they're amazed that they sound as they do.
That's wonderful.
So in a sense, the building is doing half the work for us. And because it is the chapel of the Virgin Mary, that's exactly where, when there was still a monastic abbey at Ely, there isn't any more, but there was in the Middle Ages, that's where they went to sing Compline every evening. And so it's just very historic, because we were following in the footsteps of people who were singing there 6 centuries ago. and much the same music. So that was the basis of it. I decided this would have to be a double album, that the Office of Compline itself is 20 minutes, and let's put that on one disc, and let's have another disc just of the polyphonic music appropriate to it, which mostly comes from the Renaissance period, which, of course, has always been a favourite of mine. But at the same time, there are one or two romantic inclusions as well. I've got some Rachmaninoff and some Rheinberger, which seem to just fit,
yes,
I think, very comfortably with this earlier music.
Yes.
I mean, why not? You know, across the centuries, composers have loved the sound of choir. And when the poetic impulse behind it is very much the same, it doesn't matter whether it was written in 1550 or in, as Rachmaninoff wrote his Ave Maria in 1915, part of the, and so somehow they all fit together, and we had two absolutely magical days recording in the cathedral. I just wouldn't have missed it.
I probably just went as easily as possible, because I think the inspiration of the whole ambiance of the cathedral, and of course I am sure that the choir responded to that, and it sang even better. You know, it does work. I have to tell you, I went to Greenwich, this is a few years ago, and we took the Thames boat. I went with my daughter, and we got off at Greenwich, and we were just walking around the town, and I saw this, you know, church there, and somehow I heard some music coming from there, and don't you think, we walked over, and it was the church. I don't know the name of the church, but it's the one where the Thomas Tallis is there. And it was the most exciting experience, because they were preparing for a concert, I believe. It was just a local orchestra that was going to be playing a concert there. And then I walked in there, and there was a stained glass window, you know, and so I think part of a keyboard that he had perhaps, you know, played on. I'm, this was so exciting, because, you know, I mean, to just stumble upon that. We looked in the guidebook, and I think they did have something in there about that, but it was a find, and to stumble upon it and find that music was being made there today, you know.
Yeah.
It was very
exciting. Exactly. I mean, we should never underestimate that. And even though the singers I'm dealing with are young professionals, it means a lot to them to have the opportunity to perform somewhere with such a long history and such an evocative atmosphere. So it also gets them out of London, you know, because
yes.
Despite the name, the Cambridge Singers are London-based, really. That's where they pretty well all live. And to just take 2 days out of time and to just live with William Byrd and Palestrina,
yes,
and Lassus, mm-hmm, and Victoria, mm-hmm, and all of these composers, and sing some of these timeless old chants is something that they all said to me afterwards, well, gosh, you know, we've enjoyed recording all our albums, but this one really, really was very special. So it was an album that once I'd made it, I just thought to myself, why ever didn't I do this before? Because it was kind of a project waiting to happen in a way. But you never know when ideas are going to come to you, as I have learned as a composer. And the same is true with the recording project. I think it's important to only make an album when you really have got a project that you believe in.
Well, it's a far cry from the Beatles concerto, I can tell you.
That was the Beatles concerto. I'd almost forgotten about that.
Oh, my goodness.
That was commissioned by a piano duo. I was actually at high school with them. And they had asked for a grand romantic extravaganza based on Beatle tunes. And all dressed up in the style of Tchaikovsky and Rachmaninoff and Grieg and Schumann and all of the romantic masters. And so I kind of...
And you did it, let me tell you.
I did it. I planted my tongue firmly in my cheek and had a ball, you know, shamelessly robbing,
yes,
all of these great composers.
You certainly did. I have to tell you, you did. But we get a tremendous response from it, I must
Well,
tell
it
you.
Was a piece of fun, and it was not meant disrespectfully, really. The thing is, every composer stands on the shoulders of his predecessors, and I was just, shall we say, making the debt to all of them, particularly obvious in that case. But it was just a piece of fun. I mean, sometimes there's not enough fun around in music, and so that was really what that was
but
all
what
about.
You...
And I may say I'm a Beatles fan.
Oh, so. John Rutter, our guest today here on Crossover. I'm Jill Pasternak. Until next time.